Gonna keep me on tape, huh? I gotta be honest?
On CD.
Thank you very much. My name is Howard Kellogg, and I am an alcoholic. First of all, I'd like to express my gratitude to Larry for asking me to come over and speak. Also to my friend Steve, who got me here. He piled me in his car and handcuffed me and brought me up. My sobriety date is May 17th, 1974. And for each of those days, I have eternal gratitude to you people. People in Alcoholics Anonymous all through this world have made it possible for me to be here today. I started drinking, depending on, I guess, your point of view and your age. I started in a pretty late age. I know people now that start when they're 3 or 4 years old, and I've actually talked to somebody who's had alcohol in their baby bottle. But I was 18 years old when I started drinking. I'd already graduated from high school. I really wasn't going to drink because I didn't like the way my father acted when he was drinking. He's mean. So I wasn't going to drink. But I saw everybody else drinking and thought it looked like fun, so I decided to do it. I called a friend of mine up, and I should have known this. I mean, I wish somebody would have told me right away what alcoholism was all about. I didn't know my father was an alcoholic. I just knew he drank a lot. And that he got really mean. If I'd have known what alcoholism was about, I probably would have done it anyway. But I called up my best friend at the time. I was living out in Issaquah by Pine Lake. And I called up my best friend and I said, you know what, I'm tired of driving you people around. I was their designated driver for a while. I said, I want to go out and find out what this is all about. So can we go out and get drunk? I didn't say, can we have a drink? I'd like to have a drink or two. I said, I want to go out with you and get drunk. And so he said, sure, let's do that. And I was driving a 1955 Chevy. Yeah, my first car. And I went and picked up my friend Alan, and he had two bottles of, this is my first drink, Mogan David Blackberry Wine. I love the way it made me feel. I felt like 10 feet tall and bulletproof. We actually went to a place that was in Kent called the, anybody from that area might remember this back then. This was around 1968. And it was called the El Rancho Drive-In. Drive-In Theater. And we ended up drinking those two bottles of Mogan David Blackberry Wine. And we finished them and I said, I want more. So we left there and went to Tukwila, to a friend's house. He went out and bought a case of beer and we drank that. And I was in no shape to drive my car back to Pine Lake. So my friend Alan drove the car. And several times along the way, he stopped so I could get out of the car and vomit. Put it nicely. And he got me home, and I don't know how I got in the house. I don't know how I got in bed. And I remember waking up the next day and thinking, God, I had fun last night. I want to do this again. And I did, many, many times. They say, at least I've heard, that the definition, one definition of alcoholism, I guess, is that if drinking causes a problem, it is a problem. Father Martin used to say, what causes problems is a problem. And the first thing to suffer from my drinking, I was attending Bellevue Community College. And that's the first thing that went, because I was too busy out drinking and having fun. And my college advisor called me into her office, or his office, I don't remember at the time, and said, you're not doing well in your classes. And if you don't buckle down, you're going to fail. Well, I don't fail. I withdraw. And this was 1968, and I withdrew from college. Now, I had something else at the time that suffered from that. There was a thing called the draft. And they didn't have those lottery numbers yet. And I had a student deferment. And they took it away from me. So I became classified 1A. And I got a little letter in the mail saying, the President of the United States would like to talk to you, kind of. I said, I don't want to do that. So I ran down to the U.S. Air Force recruiter and signed up and joined the Air Force. And I did that for one reason. I didn't want to go in the Army. That was my draft evasion. I'm going to evade the draft by joining the Air Force. I also avoid going to that place over in Southeast Asia that was going on at the time, called Vietnam. So, see, I'm great mind. 18 years old, knew everything. So I went in the Air Force, went through basic training, got selected to go to security police school, and then volunteered to become a canine dog handler. And after I volunteered to be a dog handler, partway through the program, they let me know that all dog handling graduates were going straight to Vietnam. So that's where I ended up. These are great plans of such a great mind. And I did my tour there, came back to the States. And to make a long story short, I ended up spending 8 years in the United States Air Force. Two of those years was in a little place called the United Kingdom. I served 2 years in the UK at a little place outside of Oxford, England, called RAF Upper Heyford. Now, I drank a lot when I was in the Air Force. I drank a lot in Vietnam, I drank a lot stateside, and I got to England, and they warned me. They said, you gotta be careful drinking over here because the stuff they serve in the pubs is not the same thing that you've been drinking back in the States. I said, that sounds good. It's a lot stronger. And I love the pubs. Unfortunately, as I usually did, when I drank, I got into a little trouble. And I had a DUI in a little town called Bedford, England. That was actually my second DUI. I had one at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, too. But I ended up not being able to drive for a year, and I thought, this is good alcoholic thinking. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic. I thought, this isn't a bad thing. You know, I can't drive for a year. That means I can't get in trouble. I can drink all I want now, and I won't be driving, so I won't get in trouble. Shortly thereafter, I got really drunk and got in a fight, and the security police came to arrest me, and I told them I wasn't going with them. Fine going. They threw me down on the floor, cuffed my hands behind my back, picked me up, said, you're going with us. I said, no, I'm not. Well, one of those poor guys ended up with a broken arm. One of them ended up with a broken nose. One of them I kicked in the back of the head. This is all after they handcuffed me. And that resulted in being court-martialed for assaulting four security policemen and convicted. And because I'd served a number of years in the military and a couple tours in Vietnam, the court-martial went light on me. They took a stripe away and some money away and said, don't do that, you're a bad boy. But they didn't kick me out. My commanding officer was really angry because he wanted me out. So he decided to get me out of the Air Force. He was going to make me go to alcohol treatment. This was back in 1974, and they didn't do a lot of treatment around then, but he sent me to a treatment program at a place called Mildenhall, RAF Mildenhall. And the treatment program the Air Force put together was on a mental health unit. And there were about 10 of us alcoholics in our alcoholic group, and there was about 20 other people with various mental illnesses. And in the morning, we all got together and had our group, and then we split off. And interesting thing about the way the treatment center worked is that they had what they called a patient government. and yet reach different levels and things like that. Well, my fame, or my claim to fame, I guess is what it is that in the Nut Ward at RAF Lake Heath in 1974, I got to be president of the Nut Ward. The alcoholics tended to rise to the top, you know, president, vice president, all of us were the alcoholic part. And I didn't want to be in treatment. I was not an alcoholic. I was 23 years old. I knew exactly what an alcoholic was. My father had an uncle that was an alcoholic, and he told me what an alcoholic was. They're unemployed. They drink cheap wine out of a paper bag, and they live under a bridge. And they don't eat. They don't eat, because that's why they get diseases, because they don't eat. Well, I ate. You can see I still do that. I didn't live under a bridge. I was 23. I had a car, even though I couldn't drive it. I still owned it. I had a job, even though I kind of messed a lot of that up, but I still was in the Air Force. And I was just too young. I had all these excuses. And I went through this 28-day inpatient program really angry and bitter and negative. And it came time to get out, and all of a sudden I got scared. Because I didn't know what I was going to do when I left there and had to go back to my place of duty at just outside of Oxford. I didn't know what I was going to do, because I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. I had all these excuses. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I just thought they were old, and I wasn't old. I thought they were about Steve's age. But realize at 23 years old, the people around me, even in AA, were most of them that were around at that point in time were in their 50s and 60s. I was just young. And everybody I knew drank like I drank. But I left that treatment program scared because I didn't know what was going to happen. And I went back to Upper Hayford, England, not knowing what I was going to be doing. And a young man there who was in this program, and he was also a counselor on base, and he got me to my first AA meeting outside of the treatment program. And I met someone there. I met a lot of people. But I met one man there who kind of formed my life for me in a lot of ways. He was quite old. Ted was 52.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, pretty old. He was sober forever. He had 8 years sober. I thought he was so dry if it was magic, he'd go up in flames. But he took me under his wing and he treated me almost like a son. He invited me over to his house. I remember my first Christmas sober I spent with him and his wife at their home outside of a little place called Banbury, England. And we went to meetings in the area. And I was off for about a week or two from my job, and I didn't know what I was going to do for Christmas, except I knew what Christmas was. It was a big party time. And Ted took me to his house. And Ted shared with me what hopefully I can share with other people during my lifetime. And that was some experience. He talked about how his drinking impacted his life and the life of people around him. Not only that, though, he told me how he'd gotten involved in this cult of alcoholics, this group of Alcoholics Anonymous, how he'd gotten involved in it, and how, before he finally sobered up permanently, he'd actually resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous 8 times. He didn't call it relapsing, so I just resigned, went out and drank. And he told me all about the experiences he had and the strength of the group of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people around him and some of his sponsors and people he worked with. And then he did something else, and say he took me under his wing, but he did more than that. I had been sober a short time. I got sober in May. I think it was about August of 1974, when he took me to Oxford, England, to the Oxford Mini Assembly. It was a one-day thing, similar to what they do over in Berrien, the Berrien Little Assembly. And he took me to that, and I met a lot of people and listened and learned. And then a couple of months later, it was October of 74, he called me up and he said, pack your bags, we're going to go somewhere for the weekend. He took me to a little village in the southern tip of England called Selseyville. It was what they call a holiday village. In England, the holiday is a vacation, what we call a vacation. He took me down there, and what was going on was the All England Wales Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. The week before that, the World Service Conference had been held in London. And so there were people who stayed over from that, people from the United States, South America, Canada. I get you in there, Larry. And by the way, you're not supposed to eat while I'm talking. And people from Africa, all over Europe, countries all over the world. We had about 1,100 to 1,200 people at that conference. It was 3 days. Went to a lot of workshops. And Saturday night. You know what we do Saturday nights at conferences? We dance. They had a band, and I was dressed. I turned 24 by this time, turned 24 in July, and I was decked out. Now remember, this is 1974. Double knit pants, slacks. Burgundy,
disco queen,
pink shirt, ruffles, white tie, white jacket, white shoes, white belt. Yeah, disco. I was hot. And I danced all night long with everybody. And I went to sleep that night in they had cottages instead of a hotel room, these little cottages. With my ears ringing. It reminded me of my high school days when I went to high school dances. The music was loud, so loud, your ears would ring for the whole night. I was hooked. Hook, line, and sinker, just reel them in. I had fun. And I learned that Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery does not have to be glum. We are not a glum lot, right? I learned what being happy, joyous, and free. At least I started to learn what that meant. And I got really involved. Now my sponsor was really cool. He'd get me involved in all kinds of things. While I was there in England, I served my home group as the secretary, the treasurer. Of course, I started off as the coffee maker. I served as the intergroup representative for the Greater Oxford Intergroup of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it came time, after a while, the US Air Force said, it's time for you to leave England. And I was sober about 14 or 15 months when I finally left England, and they reassigned me to the. I went from the most beautiful place in the world, or one of the most beautiful places. I loved England and the London area, Oxford area, and I was reassigned to a beautiful tropical Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I ended up in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and one of the first things I did was look up Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in for a rude awakening. You people in the United States didn't do it right. This was not AA. What's it? They would start the meeting reading the how it works, this preamble thing, and the tradition. They never did that in England. They'd end up with the Lord's Prayer, and they never did that in England. And they had these things called, I don't know, Al-Anon clubs? Never heard of one of those things before. Everything was different. And I go, why is this? But you know what I did? I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous, got a sponsor at Grand Forks Air Force Base. We did not have a meeting at Grand Forks Air Force Base then. And I arrived there, I think it was about September of 1975, I arrived at Grand Forks. And another guy came in a couple months later who was in the program. And he said, we don't have a meeting on base. That was wrong. So him and I started the survival group at Grand Forks Air Force Base. And I don't know if it's still going or not. That's been a long time ago. But I helped start that group and got involved again in service to the group. Served as a GSR for that group and secretary for that group. And then a year and a half later, it came time to that for my third enlistment. I had 8 years active duty, and I was planning to go the whole way. And when it came time to reenlist, the U.S. Air Force, in their infinite wisdom, said, if you reenlist, and we want you to, but we got to tell you this, you're not going to leave Grand Forks for 4 years. You're going to stay in North Dakota for 4 years. And I'd just gotten married and had a child. Nah. I got another choice. I'm getting out. And so I left the U.S. Air Force. And I moved back to Kent, actually. I moved to Kent, and that's where I ran into my friend Steve. It was 1977. And my first home group in Kent was the Green River Group. And Steve attended that group, along with a lot of other people. I remember going over to Steve's house and having wonderful sober parties, and meeting his family, getting involved, and getting involved in my home group. Again, getting involved in service as much as I could. And after a while, Steve kind of disappeared. I didn't know what happened to him, but I remember calling him up one day, and he was not doing really well. And conversation is not real important. I just told him he needed to take a hot shower and I was going to come over. And I went over and talked to him, and he ended up going to treatment. And that was in May of 1979, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah.
And I've been Steve's sponsor since then. We've gone through a lot together. Now, I only mention that because I think it's important. You know, Steve has said, and you may have heard him say this, I know I've heard him say it, and I don't agree with him at all. Seriously, he says, Howard, you saved my life. I said, no, I didn't. You saved mine. That's the truth. Dr. Bob didn't save Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson didn't save Dr. Bob's life. It was the other way around. I believe strongly in what Bill Wilson gave us and what the founders gave us, and that is that in order to keep this thing, we have to give it away. You know, if Steve hadn't been there in need and allowed me to be part of his life from that day forward, I may not be here. He kept me busy. Now, he really did keep me busy. We went to a lot of meetings together. I went up to the hospital when he was in treatment, saw him. We've been many, many meetings together, but he kept me busy in other ways, too. I remember, I don't even remember what year it was exactly, but it was after Steve got through treatment. He called me up one day and said, I'm going to go on a bicycle ride. He bought a real nice bicycle. He says, I'm going to go on a bicycle ride. It's called, get this, Chili Hilly. Okay? And it was the last Sunday in February. I know it. It's chilly. On Bainbridge Island. It's hilly. 32 miles around the island, up and down hills. He says, you want to go to Chili Hilly and ride with me? And I had an old 10-speed bike that probably weighed 100 pounds. Just an old clunker. It's too cold. He talked me into it. I went on Chili Hilly. Then we went on another ride. It was called Team Green Death. That's a weird ride, but it was a fun ride. And so we're riding this 100-mile ride, and he says, you know what? We ought to ride Seattle to Portland. You got to be kidding me. Okay. We Seattle report. And we got into a lot of, that was back in the mid-80s. Seattle, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, BC. So what happens in 1991? Steve calls me up and says, he's never ridden a motorcycle in his life. He says, I went and bought a Harley Davidson. He bought a 91 Heritage Softail. He says, now I'm going to go learn how to ride it. Do you want to go to motorcycle school? No, Steve, I don't want to go to motorcycle school. When I was really younger, about 21, I rode a little Honda Trail 90 over in Spokane for about 3 months. That was my extent of my riding. Wasn't interested. But it's only $30, and we'll have fun. Okay. So we went to motorcycle school together. And that was in 1991. I got hooked. Bought a bike. A few years later, another friend needed some help on getting his endorsement. Steve, myself, another friend named Henry, who's my sponsor now, and Roger all went to the Experience Rider course. And during that, there was a little thing on the wall that says, are you interested in becoming an instructor? How do you do that? And the guy saw a fish coming. Well, that was 2002. And I ended up going through an instructor program, and today I'm still an instructor for the Motorcycle Safety Foundation. And that's what I do for a living today. I get to go have fun playing with motorcycles and teaching people to ride and get paid for it. It is awesome. I love doing it. But that's my life. That, along with coming to meetings and sharing experience, strength, and hope, and being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group, I mentioned it earlier, I want to put a plug in. The Brunch Bunch meets in Kuala. We meet Sundays. The meeting starts at 10:30, goes to 12. Has a wonderful buffet brunch. And good food, wonderful sobriety. A lot of people there that have a lot of years of sobriety, and a lot of new people. This is what I really like about it. We get a lot of new people at that meeting, too, because I really believe, you know, I can stand up here, I've been sober for, in May I celebrated 41 years. That's a long time. I drank for 5.5 years. Been sober a long time. I love this program, and I love the people in it. But you know, the true, if it isn't for new people, this program shrivels up and dies.
Yes.
Really does. Those people coming in, if we don't reach out and help, one of the things I see about Alcoholics Anonymous now that bothers me is groups that don't want new people. The groups that just say, you know what, we got too many people coming from treatment centers. My God, Bill and Bob would go try to drag people into out of bars and anywhere else they could find them. And go to the hospitals and look for people. You know what? We're here to be of service to those people who need us. Now, my first sponsor, Ted, told me Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people who need it. It's for people who want it. There's a little difference there. But if you walk in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't care how you get here. I was forced here. I didn't wake up one day and say, hey, it's a good day to go to AA. I was forced into this program against my better judgment, which wasn't very good at the time, against my will. And I was kicking and screaming. But people held out their hand. I couldn't drive for a full year on the Queen's Road. DUI in England, it's a whole year. So I couldn't drive from the base out to Oxford or out to Banbury or out to Aylesbury or out to Stowe, all these little villages. That's where the AA meetings were. My sponsor Ted lived in Banbury. He'd come on the way to Oxford, pick me up and take me to Oxford. Somebody from Oxford on Friday would come pick me up and take me to Banbury. Somebody else would take me up. They took me all over the place. Every night, somebody else would come pick me up and take me to a meeting. Now, Sunday, there were no meetings in the area, but every once in a while, several of us, this is another thing I miss. We get together, four or five of us, get on a train, go to London, hit a meeting in London, and then go to a movie or something, and then take a train back. We went to a lot of meetings and got involved in a lot of social activities. This is great. You know what? A potluck, having some idiot up here talking. But it's a lot of fun to come and have some good food and some good fellowship. We are not a glum lot. There's a lot to do in Alcoholics Anonymous other than go to meetings and talk about how terrible we were back then or whatever. I tend not to do a whole lot of that. I like what's going on today. So what's happening? We're almost in September. Guess what's happening in September? Some of you may or may not know about this. But over in Tacoma, we have a thing called the Sponsorship Conference. It's a three-day conference at the La Quinta Inn in Tacoma. I know that there's a conference up in Port Angeles every May. I also know that in May, there's one over in the Tri-Cities called the Inland Empire Roundup. There's one down in Seaside, Oregon every year. There's a lot of things, not only in the state of Washington and down in Oregon, but also locally. A lot of things going on, not only here in this area, but over in the Tacoma, Seattle area, too. Well, you don't have to be bored. I've been involved with Clean and Sober Bowling many years. A bunch of us get together and go bowling. And when I was living in Federal Way and I was fairly new back to this area still, we had, after a Friday night meeting in Federal Way, we had a group of us that went to the Seacoma Village and we call it bowling with bozos. I found out years later I was the bozo that they were talking about. But no, we had fun. A lot of us would get together, the Federal Way men's group, and we'd go to the Mariners game. Or we'd go to a Seahawk game. They have golfing tournaments for those of those people that golf. I don't golf. And there's a lot of us in the program that ride motorcycles and do stuff with that. No matter what you like to do, there's somewhere to do it within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with people who are clean and sober and in recovery. Now, while that sounds wonderful, and I think it does, it is wonderful. It takes some work. It isn't just come to AA, quit drinking, everything's wonderful. There is something that I had to do, and that is I had to take those steps and those traditions and figure out how they apply to my life and be able to live them. I hear people say, well, I did the step. Well, I have to live this step. I heard one speaker say, I've never taken a step. Or no, what he said was, I've never done a step. I never did the steps. I took the steps. Because here are the steps we took. We took the steps. And he said, he took the steps. So you take them, you live them, I think. It isn't about just having the fun and games, which I talked about. Because those things are important. But if I don't take the principles of this program and I don't take those steps and find out how they apply to me and try to live them to the best of my ability, I won't be sober enough to do those things. I won't. If I don't make myself available on some level for some service to my group, to the district, to what it, some people to the area, I won't have anything to give away. And the biggest thing, I think, that we can do, and it comes down to what Bill said, and that is the real secret of AA is one drunk talking to another drunk. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. You can have doctors, psychiatrists, and counselors, all these people telling us, you should do this, this is what you should do. It never did me any good. But when somebody sat down and told me what their life had been like, what had happened to them, and what they were like now, what they'd gone through, and how they came through the other side, and how they were living in recovery, not only told me, but showed me, And believe me, Ted showed me, and other sponsors have shown me, and still do. When that happens, something magical happens in me. At least it did. I realized that the greatest gift that God ever gave to me was alcoholism. It really was. I didn't think so initially. I thought it was a horrible thing. You know what? It's allowed me to become a better person. It's allowed me to reach out and to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with people like Steve and many others. Many others. And it's those people that help me stay sober. It's not, I haven't done that for them. They've done that for me. And one thing I want to share in, before I finish, I have a young man. He's got about 11 years sober now. He had a lot of struggles. Get a year, get 2 years, relapse. Got into various substances. And at one point, someone in the program said to him, you need to get a different sponsor. Because your sponsor ain't keeping you sober. And he called me up and told me, and he said, hey, you know what? If you want a different sponsor, that's okay. You know, I got no problem with that. He said, no. He said, it isn't you. Of course it's not me. I can't ever sober anybody up. I can't keep anybody sober. I'm not that powerful. I can share my experience, strength, and hope, but you have to take it and do what you will with it. You, and same with me. I mean, when my sponsor shared that, he didn't carry me, he carried a message. But I had to do something with it. I had to follow the steps and follow the program and work the steps, put them into my life, and then share them with other people. Don't do that, I've got nothing. But with that, I've got a pretty darn good life. Things can go wrong. I tell you about all the wonderful things. I've not been a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous, believe me. You know, when I was drinking, I was married. And we got divorced before I got sober. But in sobriety, I've been married 3 times. And divorced 3 times. So, am I looking for my 5th ex-wife right now, or no? No, I quit that. But the reality is that I've done some things that I didn't work out. You know, I've had several different jobs and several different careers. So, I've been through bankruptcy sober. These aren't things I'm proud of. It's just this is called life. Because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous and sober doesn't mean I'm perfect. In fact, not even close. I'm a human being that makes a lot of mistakes still. And I'll probably make some more. I've yet to meet the perfect person, so I'm not it. Yeah. On the other hand, wonderful things happened. I was able to go back to school and, you know, I dropped out of college. Well, after I got sober, I was able to go back to college. And 11 years sober, I graduated from the University of Washington with a degree in English literature. Love it. And a voracious reader even today. I have a daughter who just turned 39 and 3 beautiful grandchildren. And I get to spend time with them. My daughter never saw me drink. Grandkids will never see me drink one day at a time. But I get to be a part of their lives. My youngest grandchild just had her 6th birthday, and I was over there for her birthday party, and my ex-wife was there. And you know, we didn't yell at each other or do anything weird. You know, we had a good day. So, doesn't matter what happens, it's what I do about it. How do I respond to the things that happen? One of the most wonderful things happened about 4 or 5 weeks ago. July 19th, I was on a little scooter. I have 3 bikes. One's a Harley, one's a Ninja, and one's a scooter. I was on the scooter, and I was in a roundabout, and this lady hit me. Knocked me right off the scooter. And it didn't break anything, but banged me up pretty good. And I'm laying there on the road. And the next thing I know, there's this real beautiful lady sitting there holding my hand. I look over there, and I thought maybe she was an angel. Maybe I died. And she goes, "Are you okay?" She's the one that hit me. And the ambulance took me to the hospital, and later that afternoon, I'm in the emergency room, and this really nice lady and her husband come in to check on me. And because the scooter was total, I didn't have a way home. And you know what? I was going to call, I don't know, Steve or Henry or somebody to give me a ride home. And this really nice lady and her husband took me home, gave me a ride back to my apartment. And she called me every day for the first 3 weeks to see how I was. And even, well, let's see, today's what, Friday? I may be here from her on, it was a Sunday she hit me. Last Sunday she called me, so it's our anniversary again, I'm telling you. But you know what? I'm laying there on the ground, hurting, been hit by a car, and the first time I've been hit by a car on a motorcycle, and I wasn't angry. I didn't want to get up and beat anybody up. I was just grateful that I was breathing, and more grateful that nothing got broken. And now I have a new friend, the one that hit me. The old me would have attempted to get up and start fighting. I don't do that today. Usually, not mostly. I try not to. What I do know is you've given me a lease on life. You've given me a purpose for life. You give me happiness and joyousness and freedom. I love being happy, joyous, and free. I love being able to be involved with such a wonderful group of people. I really do. Alcoholics, actually, I was going to say in recovery, but it's not necessary. Alcoholics are really cool people. We're much cooler when we get sober. But you know what? I understand the ones that are drinking still. And you know what? They're still good people. And if I ever get to the point where I say, because you go out and relapse, you're less than anything, then I'll probably drink. Because it could happen to any of us.
That's right.
At any time. I believe, I need to extend that hand and say, welcome back. Mm-hmm. Welcome back, and what can we do to help? Okay. I've been fortunate. I don't know why. God's blessed me. I've been sober since the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've had a lot of mental relapses, emotional relapses. I just didn't drink. You go through 3 divorces sober, something's wrong. And I could like to blame them, but it ain't going to work. But I'm still here and sober today, and I still can learn, and I can still have a good life because of you. It's not something I've really done. It's because of you. And the neat thing is, this is everywhere in the world. I've been to meetings, like I said, got sober in England, North Dakota, lived in Oregon for a while, Washington. No matter where I go, and no matter where any of us goes, there is a fellowship of men and women who are willing to share their experience, strength, and hope with us and extend the hand and say, welcome home. You're in the right place. Thank you.
Get a hug.
Oh, I love those.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's give him another hand. You are very welcome.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's see. We'll need help cleaning up. We can circle the wagons and we'll close with a serenity prayer.
Wow, that's great attendance you have.
All the cream of the crop.
God.
Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change,
I think they made it all the way around. But if you didn't find one,